volume up. It's Labor Radio.
Good evening. You are tuned in to Labor Radio, and your hosts this evening are Michael Morrow. Good evening, Michael.
Good evening, Lane. And Lane Ponce.
Thank you very much. And we have a couple wonderful guests here this evening. We're going to start with a couple announcements, and then we'll move into a discussion with a local author. And her husband is here also, who is a retired bookseller. So we've got an active discussion going on this evening. Michael, what sort of announcements did you have going?
Well, one of our guests shortly will announce the upcoming Northwest Labor History Conference in May, going to be up in Canada. That will be upcoming. The thing that I wanted to remind folks was the value of our Northwest Labor Press, which is a wonderful periodical that comes out and fills us in. It's online if you want to check it out online. They do a great job. nwlaborpress.org. And in the recent copy, they talk about the Staples boycott ending. This was the post office's early attempt a few years ago to privatize the post office. The postal workers fought against this. They were allowing the Staples folks to basically become postal workers in the Staples stores. It took a couple of years to make this happen, but the American Postal Worker Union, good folks, won this. And by the end of this month, end of February, Staples will stop doing that. And so they will no longer be post offices in Staples stores. And that's the kind of news that you get in the Northwest Labor Press. So I highly urge people to stay on top of that publication.
Okay. Thank you, Michael. I have some information to share with our listeners. There's a lot going on in the community around the events around the Trump election. One place for good information is called Indivisible Oregon. It's a Facebook page. And it also has what's called the Indivisible Guide. Both of those are available online, and they tell you what's going on in the community and how to engage at a local level. So we're encouraging people to do that. You have issues with labor questions or social questions, it's a good place to check in. So let's start with introductions. This evening we have Mr. Bob Green. He is the retired bookseller who is going to talk to us a little bit about some things that are coming up and his opinion on the future connected with the past. We also have Sue Armitage. Did I pronounce that right, Sue?
Armitage.
She is an author and a scholar, a retired scholar, but probably an ongoing author. And her work is called Shaping the Public Good, Women Making History in the Pacific Northwest. So, Sue, why don't you start off with, let us know what kind of research you had to do to put this work together.
I read anything I could get my hands on. It's meant to be, it's not a piece of original research. I didn't spend years in the archives. I collected together all the books that I could find and articles about women in the Pacific Northwest from the very beginning to today and read them. Most of them, some parts, some all, because what I found is that most people write biographies of women who they think are notable in some way. But until you can string them together, which is what I did, to create a continuing story, you don't really get a sense of women in history, or at least I didn't think so. So that was my goal, which was to string together the biographies and tell them in an interesting way so that the tremendous public ignorance about what women really have done and their role in history could be filled in at least a little bit.
Yes, it was a very inclusive kind of book because it started out with the cave dwellers and ended up in the year 2000 plus.
I'm not sure that the ancestors of our current Native Americans would be happy being called cave dwellers. But anyway, I know what
coastal,
you mean.
Coastal dwellers.
Well, that's true. Some of them did live in caves. Yeah.
No, you
true.
Did a really nice job of weaving in the Native Americans into the story for every decade. Most of the chapters are kind of in chunks of two decades or so.
About that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then following every chapter, you have extensive notes on the things that you borrowed from, as
yes,
you said.
Yes, I wanted people to know where to go if they wanted to know more about a particular event or a particular woman. And I actually insisted to the press, which was Oregon State University Press, that the notes be right there at the end of the chapter. You know, if you if you read a scholarly book, almost always the notes are at the end. And how many times are you going to flip back and
forth? It's so exhausting to flip to the end. This is much better.
Yes,
thank you.
Thanks.
Do you have a question for her, Michael?
Well, unlike Lane, I've not read the book. I did spend a little time online, though, looking at the blurbs and what people had to say about the book. And it is available, if we don't think to remind folks by the end of the show. If you you can go to Amazon. It is published by OSU's Press, but you can go into Amazon. The title of the book is Shaping the Public Good.
I'd prefer to have you go to a local bookstore, please.
What a great idea.
Yes, thank you.
I know. I was getting daggers from Bob, who was, a small bookseller. Good idea. I didn't check Powell's to see if they've got one, but there are other small bookstores, a few still in town on that.
Mm-hmm,
right.
Mm-hmm.
But The little blurb that most impressed me, that was actually a nice one by Ursula Le Guin, but the one that I liked was Karen Blair, who has edited Women in Pacific Northwest History, and what she said was, be forewarned if you've succumbed to the myth that it was he-men who developed the Pacific Northwest. Now the trappers, loggers, miners, cattlemen, and railroad builders, who we all think of as developing the Pacific Northwest, must make room for many women of every race and ethnicity who contributed. Armitage puts faces to the entrepreneurs, homesteaders, journalists, lobbyists, activists, schoolteachers, and Rosie the Riveters who populated the region. So one of the things that we will, I hope, in addition to talking about how to put this book together, was maybe to begin to link these pioneers with the women in the Pacific Northwest today who are out there helping to make change.
And also, we might mention that you are a finalist for the Oregon Book Award.
Yes, that's very nice.
Yes, and that comes up, did you say?
The award ceremony is the end of April. I think it's April 24th. I can't remember the exact date.
And that you can find information about that on the Literary Arts web page or Facebook page.
Yes.
They have a lot of information about the Oregon Book Award. You were just nominated recently, right?
Mm-hmm.
How many contenders in your section?
In my category, I think there are five or six others.
Okay. So, well, we wish you luck. And,
well, thank you
very much.
Because
we don't know the others yet.
No, you will, though. I mean, some of them will be familiar, I'm sure.
Yeah. Okay. All right, Bob, you want to give us a little rundown on some of the information you brought with you today?
Sure. Basically, I want to announce the 2017 Pacific Northwest Labor History Conference in Vancouver on May 26, 2017. It's the 100th anniversary of the Russian Revolution, the decades of radicalism and Red Scares of labor movements in the Pacific Northwest. But most of the panel discussions deal with government spying and suppression of labor union and radical movements. Just as I'm afraid our minority rule affirmative action president and his gangsters plan for us. What we need to do is, first of all, be aware of your rights. Second of all, be organized and join other movements. Things like KABU is going to be important because they're going to sell off the airwaves on public radio. You'll have KABU and you'll have places like KLCC. And Eugene, that will still be on the air. KABU is having a membership drive February 8th. So this is important that you take out your membership. And if you don't want to do it, give it as a Valentine's gift for someone. I don't want to be too gloom and doom. I actually think this is a good time for younger people because for the first time in my 70 years, I think you can see that the challenges to what passes as the standards of American life and the way of doing things are up for grabs. I think you can figure out new ways of doing things and presenting them. It doesn't have to be the same old methods, which are basically for the concentration of wealth. The youth today have a chance to start demanding what they need. So I have been, as you are now, but you need to do stuff for yourself so you can be like I am today. You have to demand what you need to be able to live the life you want to lead. You work to live and you not live to work. You do need to demand those things that will enrich your life and make it a government that will allow you to thrive and get its foot off your neck. This is meant to be a country where people determine what happens to them. You need to have some say in what happens to them, and the way you do that is joining with other people to amplify your voice. You don't have to be alone.
Right. And you see a lot of that action going on now. What's interesting is that I'm a member of the Pacific Northwest Labor History Association, and I've gone to many conferences, and I know that it almost takes 2 years to put on a conference. So they were wise enough to know 2 years in advance that the British Columbia arm of the Pacific Northwest Labor History, that this would be a topic that would be of interest to us. So it's been coming our way. The Red Scare, and you also spoke of the Red Scare in your book. Tell me more about what research you did on the Red Scare with women and their involvement that came up in your book.
I think you want to talk about two different periods of time. First of all, the period, of course, after the First World War, when the IWW was basically hounded out of existence, and most of the people who were involved with it, men and women, basically were silenced. But the one example that I quote at some length is from Sandy Polishek's story about Julia Rutila and her lifelong dedication to workers' rights. And she has some wonderful quotes, which I quoted in my turn. When Julia was brought up before one of the HUAC committees and was so incredibly frustrated at what she could and couldn't say that her lawyers literally, when she popped up to say something, would grab her and sit her back down so that she wouldn't end up being either in contempt of the committee or whatever. And
that committee was called the...
It was the HUAC.
House Un-American Activities Committee.
Yeah.
Which could be revived here
yes,
any day.
Yes, yeah, seems
exactly.
to be.
Exactly, okay. Post-World War II, the McCarthy era,
right,
as we think about it. And I was delighted that book was available to really make people know how many dedicated and militant women there have been that most of us have never even heard of.
Right. And Bob, I met you at the Pacific Northwest Labor History Association because you were at a book table that had Sue's book and several other books that had to do with history and the labor movement. Are you going to be there again this year?
No, because it'll be in Vancouver and I'll be staying home.
Oh, Vancouver, British Columbia.
Columbia.
It's a little further.
Yeah, and they have a different sort of orientation in their own books. But as we're talking about the Red Scare and minority rights, one of the Federal Indian law was not codified till 1952 by Felix Cohen and his wife, Lucy Kramer Cohen. A new book called The Second Red Scare details the government's and Congress's attacks on the Cohens for being pro-Indian and extending federal rights and the constitutional rights to Indians. He died of a heart attack over the stress. She lived to be 100-something. But he died young as the harassment that they received in that. And some people in Congress have floated the idea of another Un-American Activities Committee. This is the things why you have to stay up on things and be aware. The ACLU received as much money this week as they have all last year. You have to prepare to defend your rights. It takes money. But it also takes being active and standing up and speaking for yourself and for other people and being there.
That makes a nice segue to the Women's March, because the thing that struck me here in Portland, and I think throughout the country from everything I can tell from other places, is the vast majority of people who were there weren't just turning out for one march. Many people were making it clear by their signs and by their what they were saying that they were picking a topic or an issue on which they were going to fight. And so It wasn't a one-time thing. I read an article somewhere, sometime recently, saying, oh, well, another march, what does that do? It doesn't do anything for anybody. But what really struck me were the variety of causes that were expressed in all of the signs, and just the sheer number of people and the force of resistance that was there.
With options of ways to get involved immediately.
Yeah.
And you were speaking about the American Civil Liberties Union, which received all that money as soon as all these things started happening. So there are many things that you can get involved with. And that's one of the indivisible guide books or online tips on how to get involved. And also the one in Oregon has specifics on how you can tie into groups. And the groups are very diversified. So do you have any suggestions?
It's almost ironic that it took something like the education, wouldn't that be nice, the election of someone like Donald Trump to unify all of the disparate forces out there, each of which has a focus. But he seems to be attacking basically everything and everybody.
Fast.
So the Women's March was the big tent under which and this I think is perceived by many as a strength rather than individual folks talking about immigration rights or talking about choice or talking about minimum wage or talking about all of the number of ways that we are separated and attacked as individual groups. This is a much larger group coming together, and for my part, I'm delighted to see, hopefully, that women are leading this charge.
But not alone.
I'll be there. I'll take my sign. It won't be anywhere near as interesting as
there were many interesting signs.
There were so many.
It was fun to look at the signs, and even when we were all drenched and water was dripping down the signs, they were all pretty well prepared for rain.
Mm-hmm.
You are listening to KBOO, and tonight's guests are Bob Green, a retired book salesman, and Sue Armitage, author and retired scholar. So we're continuing the conversation. And do you have any questions for either of our guests, Michael?
Oh, I think what might be appropriate at this point are some predictions about how things might play out in the next weeks, months, and beyond. Any thoughts?
Oh, I have lots of thoughts. I think predictions are a little hard to make, and they kind of, in some ways, work against things. We'll start with Trump's ban on Muslims, which is inexact. He banned Muslims from 7 countries. He has no business entities in those countries. And those countries, Muslim countries where Trump has his golf courses and such, those Muslims are still welcome. But if he doesn't have a golf course in a Muslim country, well, you can't come in.
So your passport has to have a large T on it in order to get in.
Yeah, you have to have your club show you can play your club. There'll be a lot going on. It will be an overwhelming attack on the living standards and rights of the American people. And this is a chance not only for people, especially younger people, to defend those rights, but to create a universe where those rights can blossom and can lead them on to the future they want to retire into and bring their children up. This is a chance to redefine how we do things, to start making our institutions respond to the needs of people rather than accepting a top-down boot on your neck. People have a freedom, in a sense, to create the approaches they want to take to problems. They don't have to accept what the establishment is saying. This is the solutions to our problems. This is what we've done in the past. Everyone knows that things aren't working. We have to do something. Many people voted for Trump because he was supposed to be a change. They see him as destroying the government. It's not doing anything about business. It's so loaded with billionaires, and you know, except for maybe Trump, he doesn't want you to see his tax returns because maybe he isn't as rich as he says he is. And I think we've got
all those lawsuits and failed business enterprises.
I think another way to look at the same thing is that as people, as I was saying earlier, find the cause they want to spend their time and energy on, if they haven't already done that, they're going to find out, they're going to realize the connections. And that I think, is really important as people see that their actions feed into other actions and connect. I think that's something a lot of people have been missing, which is that feeling of connection. And I think now is our chance to see those grassroots connections grow again.
Right. And I think that was evident at the Women's March.
Very much.
Because it encouraged people to get involved with whatever issue they were very mm-hmm. serious about and very passionate about. And there's avenues to do that.
To bring it back to my book, it seems to me that one of the major themes that I discovered writing it was that women found out that to get the changes they wanted, they had to organize, whether it was something that we tend to sort of disparage, like a woman's club, or a strike action at a women's plant or something like that. Women have never really agitated alone, or at least not very successfully. And what I found over time was that the women who came together in groups and worked for specific causes were the ones who made the changes.
I was interested in that, wondering about that. We have obviously women front and center today, people like Elizabeth Warren and Meryl Streep said what she said. I watched a little bit of the SAG Awards last night, and similarly, there are a lot of women in the arts who are making statements. Mm-hmm. And historically, we have seen Mother Jones and Carrie Nation and Norma mm-hmm. Rae, and most of the folks listening right now will probably not be those people. So you begin to suggest some of the things that people at home, women at home, might be able and to do today if they see that you know there are threats out there. And I think once Mr. Trump announces tomorrow his next Supreme Court nominee, those threats will be even more apparent.
Yeah, that's true. But remember, this book of mine tries to cover pretty much the history of this region as it now exists. And as I look back, what I realize is that, and we all know this, of course, is that this was a pioneer region where whoever the newcomers were, where they had to build institutions. And that's what women spent a lot of time doing. I'm thinking particularly, since you mentioned it, about cultural institutions, things like the symphonies and the libraries and the hospitals and things like that. Would not exist without all of the efforts of women, even if it was just something as simple as tapping their husband's pockets for money to get the hospital built. But that's a one-time thing. You build the cultural institutions of a town, and there they are, and maybe they stay alive and maybe they don't. But the kind of organizing that we're talking about now is a different kind. It's not starting from nothing. It's discovering what we think is really important and figuring out how to defend it.
And not lose progress that's been made.
Yes.
Right, right. Okay, well, what do you think that, what kind of issues did you see in this pamphlet for the Pacific Northwest Labor History Association that looked good to you besides the Russian Revolution? What other topics came up in that brochure?
Oh, a lot of stuff about the Canadians, which I really don't know a whole lot about. Repression and resistance deals a lot with me as a bookseller, going back to Dashiell Hammett's The Red Harvest, which is about the destruction of the unions in Butte, Montana, and the rise of corruption in Butte, part of it, and the lack of freedom. Hammett himself eventually went to jail for refusing to testify before HUAC about people who contributed to the Committee to the Foreign Born. Here we are again, trying to defend the foreign born and their rights. a lot of fiction. The mystery story is developed in the impact of labor union repression and the fight for welfare standards and health and welfare in the unions from 1914 to 1921. The United States Army occupied Butte, Montana five times over work safety strikes. Frank Little, the well-known agitator, part Indian, was murdered by Hammett, and Hammett was a lookout. He was only 17 or 18 at the time, by the Pinkertons, which at that time were acting as the U.S. what became the Federal Investigation Bureau, FBI, Bureau of Investigations. You see a beating down of people in labor in these type of areas where they try and take away labor rights. The projected nominee for the labor secretary wants to cut the minimum wage. You got it too good. They want to raise import taxes. They're going to go to consumption taxes. If you look at Canada again, when Canada went to a general sales tax, prices shot way up. It took them close to 20 years to recover from that. You'll be paying 20 to 40% more on the prices of things. It might not sound much, but if you want to start eating some green vegetables or tomatoes or such like that in the winter, they're going to come from Mexico. They're going to be very expensive, or you'll be getting hothouse tomatoes. Chance for people to develop co-ops and farm services that will supply markets in the winter when foreign Mexican Chilean grapes, I had some Chilean grapes this week, they were very good, but they're likely not to be available under Trump's demands for high tariffs.
Well, they'll be available to people like Trump and his cronies that are extremely wealthy, and the price of things is no concern. When you're in that kind of a income bracket, none of that matters. It will really be hurting the middle class and the working class people with those kind of increases. So if this is an issue that you're concerned about, there's somewhere you can go. You can check in with the Labor News, and you can check in with Indivisible Oregon, the Facebook page and the guide. So this really is a call to action. And KABU is one of the places that we have freedom of speech. So please support us in your efforts to do these things. We're about ready to close down our show.
Well, if we have folks who are interested, who are listening and interested, and I suspect some are, in the Northwest Labor History Conference, which again is going to be May 26th in British Columbia. If you've got some time and you want to attend that, we trade off. We will often have that that conference down this way.
Every third year.
Every third year. But for people who might be interested, might want to find a website, maybe get a copy of the brochure, where should they look for that?
They can look on the web. There are several websites for the Pacific Northwest Labor History Organization. This conference schedule should be going up in the next day or so on the web, but the different panels they will be having. You can look basically out your window and see history being created by people's actions today.
Yeah.
And let your friends and neighbors know about what's happening. History is an ongoing thing, and history in a sense is a letter. You're writing a letter to the future of what was needed to be done so there could be a future. And this is a chance for all young people out there to stand up and holler for yourself.
Okay. We're coming to an end, and Sue's book is The Shaping the Public Good, Women Making History in the Pacific Northwest. We hope to continue that tradition. And
look for it at your local bookseller.
At your local bookseller.
And if they don't have it, ask them to get a few copies.
And we're going to close tonight with an Ann Feeney favorite called War on the Workers, which seems appropriate. She has a new album that's a tribute to her, and it's many of her songs that she's written done by other activist artists. So our closing song will be War on the Workers by Ann Feeney, and her new CD that's a tribute is also called War on the Workers and is available at most places where you can buy CDs. Thank you.
Bob and Sue, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Yep, we'll be back. We're Labor Radio's here every Monday, 6 to 6:30.
listen up. We've got a war zone here today, right in our heartland. And across the USA, these multinational bastards don't use tanks and guns, it's true.